Welcome to this presentation on ethical and practical considerations when engaging local counsel or co-counsel. My name is Ted Caminos. I'm a corporate partner in the Chicago office of the AmLaw 100 law firm of Fagray Baker Daniels, LLP. I also serve as a member of the firm's International Practice Group Steering Committee, and I'm presently licensed to practice law in the states of California and Illinois, as well as hold an MBA in international management. I devote a considerable portion of my practice to cross-border international mergers and acquisitions. And in that role, I've been advising on cross-border M&A deals and international corporate commercial transactions for approximately 20 years now. I've lived and worked abroad for a little over a decade and transacted in over 50 foreign jurisdictions. And as such, I found myself engaging locally qualified counsel in numerous states throughout the U.S., as well as scores of foreign jurisdictions around the world on behalf of my clients. There are scores of ethical and practical considerations to bear in mind when we are undertaking those type of local counsel engagements, which I hope we'll touch upon today during this presentation. So let's start for a minute and talk about the needs that give rise to engaging local counsel. In my case, as a transactional M&A and corporate commercial attorney, I often find myself representing clients in relation to transactions that involve acquisitions, disposals, or investments in one or more foreign jurisdictions in which I am not necessarily licensed or qualified to practice law. And so in those situations, it's incumbent upon me to source and screen and vet and engage ultimately locally qualified, locally licensed co-counsel that will ensure the project in that jurisdiction or touching upon that jurisdiction is very competently and expertly executed. But there are not only practical reasons for, engaging counsel other than yourself for these type of matters. There are also some very strong ethical reasons for doing this. Many of us are mandated by our respective rules of professional conduct, and the ABA model rules touch upon this as to the ethical considerations that must be taken into account. In my line of work, I find myself managing the key high-level definitive deal documents pertaining to an international transaction, and those will typically be governed by the laws of the state of California, the laws of the state of Illinois, even the state of Delaware. But then I need to ensure that that documentation is ultimately reviewed by local counsel in the jurisdiction that's involved and takes into account any local procedural, regulatory, and other legal requirements and impact on the transaction. And typically these sorts of issues include local antitrust filings and compliance, local share and asset transfer formalities, various public registrations or filings that may come out of the deal, and sometimes the perfection of security or collateral interests. Now, your needs for engaging local counsel or co-counsel are likely very different based on the nature of your practice. You may, for example, have a client that engages you as the national counsel to serve in a coordinating role, to work with local and regional counsel in relation to, for example, a multi-state litigation. Or you may simply lack the experience or expertise in a very nuanced legal specialization, and you may wish then to align yourself with specialized co-counsel or veteran practitioners to achieve the competence levels that you need to be able to competently carry out the mandate and yet preserve the client relationship yourself. Or you may find yourself facing a multi-jurisdictional secured loan or real estate transaction with a host of very local legal or regulatory issues to address in each of those states or jurisdictions. Or you may find yourself asked to compile a multi-jurisdictional questionnaire on regulatory compliance matters for a client that has operations all around the world. We've seen, the full spectrum of these type of mandates that often will require you to engage co-counsel. If you're like me, you may have a client that's acquiring a company that has subsidiaries in numerous foreign jurisdictions, and then you need to deal, obviously, with a whole host of transactional related issues in each of those countries. I think, because our clients are increasingly cross-border and engaged in scores of activities that often our respective firms do not necessarily have a particular licensure for that jurisdiction, or maybe it's a specialized area where we don't have the qualification or expertise, we increasingly find ourselves having to engage locally qualified legal counsel or to partner with co-counsel. And this is an aspect of practicing law that is a very important feature in the legal landscape and is one that's constantly increasing. And so with that comes, as I said, important ethical considerations and practical considerations to consider to mitigate your own liability, to ensure ethical compliance, and of course to keep your clients protected and satisfied. As I touched on earlier, virtually all states and the ABA model rules have rules and policies pertaining to the general requirements of competency, or said another way, the legal knowledge or skill that's required of us as attorneys. Most of these rules require an attorney to provide competent representation to a client, and that typically requires an attorney to have the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the relevant representation. So, in determining whether you as an attorney employ the requisite knowledge and skill in a particular matter, the relevant factors that most of these rules of professional conduct turn to are the relative complexity and the specialized nature of the matter, your general experience, your training and experience in the particular field in question, and your ability to prepare and study to get knowledgeable in the matter, or whether it's even feasible to refer the matter to or associate with or consult with a lawyer of established competence in the field. And it's that last point that many of us find ourselves gaining competence to continue to represent a client in a matter or a jurisdiction in which we may not be licensed or may not be expert or deeply experienced. So really said another way, aside from your own skills, your own knowledge and experience, you can obtain competency or provide competent representation through the association of another lawyer of established competence or licensing in the field in question or jurisdiction in question. So should you find yourself in a situation where you're asked by a client to advise on a matter touching upon the laws of a foreign jurisdiction which you're not qualified, or touching upon the subject area outside of your expertise, but the client nevertheless wants you to maintain overall control and coordination of the matter, then to comply with your ethical obligations of professional responsibility and to mitigate your own professional liability, you're probably going to want to engage locally qualified counsel or subject matter competent counsel as your co-counsel on that matter. In fact, in most jurisdictions, we are, as lawyers, forbidden to handle a legal matter that we know or should know that we're not licensed or competent to handle. So, we're actually strictly forbidden from doing it and are really required to co-counsel in those type of situations. One way of overcoming that prohibition is really to find the right type of co-counsel, and I'm going to get into some of the practical considerations now that you want to think about when you start to engage various lawyers. So let's assume that you've now found yourself instructed by a client that ethically behooves you now to engage co-counsel. Let's look at some of the practical considerations that you're going to want to bear in mind. First, I refer to what I call the due diligence stage, the sourcing and screening and vetting stage. To ensure that your co-counsel relationship is successful for everyone involved, you, the client, and the co-counsel, there's no better substitute than exhaustive due diligence. It's best to start with a general review of the candidate's reputation and competence, and typically this is done via references and inquiries. It's advisable that you as a lawyer contact other lawyers in the same geographic or practice area and solicit opinions about that potential local or co-counsel. In my experience, most lawyers are very helpful and cooperative when fielding such inquiry about their colleagues in a particular jurisdiction. Lawyers should also consult applicable state and local county bar associations and inquire as to any disciplinary actions or any other concerns that may have been raised. And then it's always advisable to just simply bolster your research, your due diligence with some good old-fashioned, simple internet searches. You'll be surprised how much you can typically uncover just by doing that, and it often provides a means to confirming that nothing is really missed. So once you've kind of conducted, you know, I'll call that preliminary due diligence staged, and decided to maybe make an approach to a particular candidate for co-counsel, I think you need to do that still with a view to continued due diligence, continued an assessment of their experience and their qualifications. And there are a few things then, once you finally decide to reach out to counsel, that we would encourage as best practice to consider. One of the first things are obviously getting their bios and experience or their resumes and requesting that the candidate provide full team bios, a list of their applicable credentials, and ideally a list of client references and a list of relevant deals or cases that indicate experience in the areas that are pertinent to the one that you have in mind for engaging that counsel for. And in my experience, it's well worthwhile to take the time to go through these materials carefully and even get on the phone or video con with that counsel and go through a detailed interview, a Q&A process about each of the matters highlighted in those credentials and discuss them and to get a good feel for the expertise of the candidate. Insurance is an important consideration as well, and you should, if you want to try to endeavor to get to best practice, I think it's always behooves you to examine the candidate's firm's level of professional liability insurance coverage and to seek evidence of that coverage and the policy limits that are described to you. You may discern that although they're qualified in the jurisdiction and are otherwise a good choice, they simply just don't have the professional liability insurance coverage that you feel would be adequate to protect your client should there be an issue of professional negligence during the course of that case or that matter. And also in a number of jurisdictions around the world, we have found that it's not uncommon for counsel to have no professional liability insurance. Many foreign jurisdictions simply don't require it. And so that's obviously an important and an often overlooked part of the due diligence review of prospective local counsel and co-counsel. Then, of course, the next step is going to be conflicts of interest. Early on in the process, you're going to want to ensure that your prospective candidate for co-counsel and his or her firm do not have any actual or potential conflicts of interest arising from or relating to your client or the underlying mandate. And you'll want to ensure that you do this carefully and examine all the possibilities of where conflict may give rise throughout the course of your project or your case, so you don't end up down the road together, only to find that a conflict has arisen that was totally avoidable had you really taken the time to explain the matter in detail with the co-counsel and examined it carefully with him or her, and then looked at all the other potential participants or stakeholders in that case or project early on. And then lastly, in terms of due diligence, we like to early on in the process also inquire and kind of discern with local counsel what requirements they have for KYC, know your client, or anti-money laundering, AML-related information that needs to be obtained from the client for that counsel to be engaged. In our experience, this can vary significantly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and it can often take quite a bit of time to comply with those requirements and to gather all the documentation and information necessary to comply with those standards. So, and this can be an issue if you're in need of urgently onboarding local counsel. Local AML or KYC requirements can often stall out the formal onboarding process. And, you know, and just by way of one example, I was recently requested to serve as local U.S. counsel to a large European law firm in a very urgent matter. And I had to admittedly, reluctantly, turn them away. They had a client that was seeking very urgent sanctions-related advice prior to entering into a contract, and they needed some urgent advice within 24 hours. And there was just no way practically I could gather the necessary KYC and AML documentation and information I needed about the ultimate client and to discern whether they were in a jurisdiction that I could even legally or ethically advise, and to also, you know, to examine if they were on an OFAC restricted list or resident in a sanctioned jurisdiction without first going through some necessary and important data collection and review. So while it can be frustrating when you're in need of urgent advice for a client, it's not untypical for local counsel's rules or policies or procedures, either legally imposed or imposed by the firm that they work for, to cause a delay in the onboarding of a client or your onboarding of local counsel or co-counsel by virtue of these know your client and anti-money laundering requirements. So in my opinion, they're always very healthy parts of your checklist to look at early and make sure that you have no unpleasant surprises. So that's the due diligence process. And so, you know, once you've kind of sourced and screened and vetted and ultimately selected local or co-counsel that you are comfortable with, then the next step of the process really is to secure your clients. And I would suggest, as a matter of best practice, secure their express written prior consent before you engage that co-counsel or local counsel. And this is important irrespective of whether you may already have a unilateral right under your own retainer agreement to associate or engage co-counsel or local counsel in your own discretion. Many clients will give you that discretion and allow you to go ahead and engage co-counsel directly on your own. We find that even if you have that power, best practice really is to go back to the client and get their express written consent for that engagement. You know, it's my practice, and this ultimately also come down to whether you are directly engaging local counsel or you're arranging for local counsel to be directly engaged by the client. It's my practice to avoid having me or my firm directly engage co-counsel or local counsel on behalf of a client. Instead, I like to take the position that we engage in the screening and vetting process and the recommending process, and we present that counsel to the client for them to be directly engaged by the client. And we will often help the ultimate client in the drafting and preparing and reviewing of an engagement letter, and even specify that we will be the primary instruction giver to local counsel. But it still is the client making the final decision to hire or not hire that counsel. And ultimately, it's the client that is directly engaging that counsel.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is BIG, B-I-G, BIG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is BIG, B-I-G. Please take a moment and write this down.
And I do find it's best practice to have a full debrief with the client in order to walk them through the due diligence process that we've conducted over that local counsel candidate and sharing our findings and our reasons for making the recommendation and selection of that counsel to the client. And ideally, I do this by organizing a meeting, a video conference or a telephonic conference with a potential co-counsel and the client directly. So it gives the client the ability to ask questions of the attorney and to determine whether the relationship is a good fit, and not simply rely on my word or my discretion for that call. And you'll see when we get into this, there's some actually very practical liability reasons that also make this a good practice. I found that courts tend to consider the degree of client input in selecting co-counsel or local counsel in a big way when deciding whether to hold you responsible for the negligence or errors of your co-counsel. In fact, there's a case, a 1993 Mississippi case, Duggins versus Guardianship of Washington, where a lawyer was held vicariously liable for the malpractice committed by his co-counsel based on the reasoning that the lawyer had exercised his sole discretion under a retainer agreement to associate with that co-counsel who later engaged in malpractice. So that really drives home the point that if you're going to use your discretion and make the final decision to engage co-counsel without seeking the independent consent of the client and educating the client on your recommendations, you definitely increase your professional liability in that matter. Now, we know it's not always possible to do this, and it's not uncommon for clients to instruct you to, take care of all those details. In fact, it's not uncommon for a general counsel of a sizable company to engage you and give you the full trust and empowerment to engage in screen counsel as he wants you to take all those issues off his plate and have you oversee and supervise that process. And even then, I still try to go back to that counsel and at least have them spend 2 minutes with me understanding what we've done and agreeing the engagement of that counsel. It's best practice. It helps to mitigate potential liability. And if you have the client involved in the selection process, approving the ultimate choice of counsel and directly engaging that counsel, it ultimately makes co-counsel more comfortable, the client more comfortable, and it mitigates your liability. Okay, so once you've gone through this, you've sourced and vetted and diligenced potential co-counsel, and you've obtained your client's prior written consent to advance with the engagement of that counsel, then really it's important to take the time to detail and craft a detailed memorialization of the arrangement or relationship in writing, to really draft a full-blown, proper engagement letter or retained letter addressing all the key terms and conditions, as well as other consideration and issues that may come up during the matter. It's really recommended that you avoid using any generic retainer letter that you may have within your firm, and instead take the time to sit down and really craft out a detailed engagement tailored to fit the specific mandate. And if you do that, I'm going to go through a host of issues I think ideally such an engagement should cover and the reasons why. The first question that you're going to want to ask yourself when preparing such an engagement that you want to give some thought to is, who are the counterparties? As I said earlier, at my firm, we have a very strong preference for the ultimate client to directly engage the co-counsel and for those two to be the parties to the engagement letter. and for the client to directly sign that engagement letter with that co-counsel. And we'll often slip in to that letter, some instructions, some guidance that co-counsel is to be led by us, to take instructions from us, to channel their communications through us. But we still find it's preferable to have the client ultimately engage counsel than to have us do it. And as I mentioned, it is unfortunately still at times where the client will push back, and it is generally accepted market practice for the client to ask you to directly engage and manage co-counsel on behalf of the client. And this may occur, as I said earlier, for example, when you're dealing with a multi-country project or transaction where the client has a strong preference for engaging just one lead counsel, one lead coordinating national firm, and then asking you to coordinate the multiple foreign firms to be centralized and controlled by you as a lead firm. And in these instances, for the reasons I noted earlier, we still want to do our utmost to at least have the client expressly agree to our direct engagement of those law firms and at least approve those firms as being within the remit of counsel that are advising them, albeit under and through us. And that way, we're at least ideally avoiding any argument that the retention of that co-counsel was based only on our discretion and actually had some formal decision-making process involving the client. Irrespective of who are the direct counterparties to the engagement letter, whether it's your firm engaging local counsel on behalf of a client, or it's your firm assisting the client in a direct engagement with that local counsel, as I said earlier, the engagement letter needs to be detailed, and it needs to make it abundantly clear who the ultimate client is and who the advice is being rendered to and for the benefit of and whom the duties and privileges belong. Oftentimes, the process can be confused where local counsel can sometimes be led to believe that they're actually advising the national law firm or the coordinating lead law firm. And you really want to avoid that, and you want to make it clear in the engagement terms that the ultimate client is the client that's engaged you, that the advice is being rendered to and for the benefit of them, and all duties, ethical and professional duties of responsibility, run to that client, and the privilege ultimately belongs to that client. So a few other details you want to tackle in your engagement letter. You'll want to ensure that it's as detailed as possible in setting out a description of the matter, the scope of work, as I like to call it. It should specify who are the designated instruction providers, what are the agreed lines of communication. It should ideally specify the division of subject matter responsibility, discern who's liable for advice rendered under certain applicable laws, and specify who the responsible parties are and expectations are in certain client-facing outputs and deliverables. If you're preparing an engagement letter that the client is entering into with local counsel directly, it's advisable for you to play a really hands-on role in crafting this engagement letter and assisting your client in specifying the division of labor, ideally the division of liability if you can do so, the methodology of client and client-related communications and instructions, and to make it clear who is the lead counsel, what the role of lead counsel is, and in terms of acting on behalf of the client. Another area we like to make sure is covered off is deadline tracking and specifying who's responsible for tracking critical deadline dates throughout the particular case or matter. At the end of the day, the clients can look to both of you and your co-counsel as to any missed deadlines. But it's important for you and that firm that you're engaging to be aware of what's likely to be involved during the underlying mandate and to discuss and specify the calendaring and tracking requirements of that project and to establish, clear lines of communication to ensure the observation of those deadlines and that no deadlines are missed. You'll also want to see that your all-important subject to fees and charges and expenses are covered off in detail. The engagement letter with local counsel should ideally include details of any agreed fee arrangements or fee structures or fee estimates, fee caps with assumptions, and whether you're going to have the regular provision of fee updates, etc. It's our strong preference, as I said earlier, to have the client directly engage local counsel. And part of this is to see that the fees are paid directly by the client to that local counsel. However, in circumstances where my firm has been requested to engage local counsel directly on behalf of a client, we then at least aim to ensure that the engagement letter and retain the letter with that local counsel makes it very clear that we pass their invoices on to the client as a reimbursable disbursement, but that we're only required to settle those invoices if, as, and when we are paid such amounts by the client. So we're trying to make it clear we're not the payor. We are a facilitator of those invoices. They flow through us. We're not ultimately responsible for their settlement, even if we directly engage at co-counsel. And to make it clear in the engagement letter, who is the party ultimately responsible for paying their invoices? I think it's not uncommon for misunderstandings to occur on that front, and very worthwhile to spend the time talking to your co-counsel about that in advance and setting that out in the engagement letter up front. In certain circumstances, you may be engaging co-counsel or engaging in co-counsel arrangements that involves a fee that's contingent in nature. And if that's the case, then there are some additional ethical considerations that you need to be alert to. As a general matter, ethical rules do permit lawyers to divide contingent fees between co-counsel, but only if certain conditions are met. And those are that the division of the fee is proportional to the services rendered by each lawyer, or that each lawyer assumes joint undivided responsibility and liability for the representation. The client agrees to a fee-splitting arrangement in writing that sets out the fee-split arrangements, and that the total fee itself is reasonable under the circumstances. If those three conditions are satisfied, under most jurisdictions, it does vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but those are general rules and the ABA rules, then fee-split arrangements that are contingent in nature are satisfied. In such contingent fee arrangements, it's also advisable for co-counsel to draft in their engagement letter clearly these arrangements, and also how any costs that need to be advanced or shared in a litigation process, such as travel, lodging, third-party experts or consultants, court transcripts, filing fees, court reporters, document production, all those type of reimbursable disbursements or out-of-pocket expenses, they're also addressed early on in the engagement letter. And you specify in advance how you're going to incur those costs, who's going to bear those costs, and maybe you put in some rules on how they'll be managed. Maybe certain costs above a certain threshold will not be incurred without the consent of the other co-counsel. The engagement letter with co-counsel should also potentially address the subject of fee discounts. As we know, that comes up oftentimes throughout the course of a matter, and you may want to establish with your local counsel right from the outset whether they or he or she will apply the same standard rate discounts that you may, as lead counsel, offer up to a certain client, or whether that local counsel will be required to discount or write down fees proportionate to what you as lead counsel may ultimately agree to write down or discount with the client. And typically we'll put that into the engagement letter, but we'll do it within some sort of predetermined or pre-agreed percentage range that we are both satisfied that if push comes to shove, we would agree to a fee discount within that range. And if it goes beyond that range, then we need to sit down and talk amongst ourselves and with the client to come to a mutual understanding. We also find it's good practice if the engagement letter, retainer letter with local counsel also specifies and addresses a number of other issues about fees, including the frequency and timing of billing arrangements and coordinating the billing process. You may have to have some standardized invoicing that needs to be delivered to the client. You may have to consolidate invoices from multiple law firms, multiple local counsel. So getting yourself coordinated in terms of the billing process and standardization of frequency is important to set out in advance. The billing currency is another issue that comes up, particularly if you're dealing with a foreign jurisdiction. In our experience, it's been good practice to have local counsel peg their hourly rates or their invoices to a dollar amount at the date of the issuance of that invoice. So you really can avoid foreign exchange risk between the date of that issuance of that invoice and the date of its settlement, whether by the client or otherwise. And the content or the format of any invoice sometimes needs to be in excruciatingly detailed format laid out in advance. You may want to require billing rates and detailed time entries and costs incurred, etc. Or they may have an e-billing system through Serengeti that needs to be addressed. But you want to make sure you deal with this in advance so you don't end up down the road with big fee exposure and people getting upset that there's delays in processing of payments of invoices because they weren't dealt with early enough in advance. Also, in certain jurisdictions, you're going to want to get a certificate of tax residency from your local counsel. That may help you avoid paying some withholding taxes or may have to deal with some VAT set-offs, VAT set-offs, depending on the location of the payor of that invoice. So you want to at least explore that up front and see if that's worthwhile obtaining and building into your processes with local counsel. Another area of sensitivity with fees that I often like to address in our engagement letters with local counsel is how fee overruns will be dealt with and who bears the risk of those overruns. As we know, it's not uncommon for an estimate to be given and then for work to be carried out and for projects to become more complicated or complex and for fees to go beyond the original estimates. We typically require local counsel to advise us well enough in advance of any any likely fee overruns so we can obtain our client's consent before those fees are incurred. So we'll often specify in advance that prior consent being required under the engagement letter before any liability for those fees arises. Also, the engagement letter with local counsel should really specify if there are any client-imposed restrictions on the type of time or expense that can be billed to the matter. We're increasingly seeing clients come at projects now with their own list of what they view as non-billable time or non-billable expenses that they would like to ensure are reflected also in the arrangements that we set out with local counsel. And oftentimes, those include invoice preparation time, running conflicts or matter opening time, any internal filing, indexing, maintaining files, faxing, printing, copying, word processing, proofreading, calendaring, docketing, scheduling, those sorts of matters are increasingly becoming non-billable, required to be non-billable by a number of particularly larger corporate clients. So look, in my experience and in our experience, you can't be too detailed when setting out an engagement letter what type of expenses and disbursements and fees can be charged. A few other guidelines that we're seeing are how reimbursable expenses will be treated. And we're seeing matters such as photocopying now being limited to actual out-of-pocket expenses with no surcharges being allowed. We're even seeing long-distance phone calls not being permitted to be charged any longer and being viewed as part of the overall billing rate that a firm charges. We're clearly seeing restrictions on travel expenses being limited to more reasonable accommodations, airfares, and lack of reimbursement for a number of related travel expenses. So, some of these may seem austere and some of them do vary from client to client and firm to firm, But in any event, the point really is to figure out what your client's criteria and requirements are up front, and then to, in a very detailed way, address these in any engagement letter that you have with your local council, so there are no unpleasant surprises down the road. Now, another area we like to tackle off in our engagement letters with local council are staffing requirements. You may want to address matters such as team continuity, senior level involvement of certain partners or experts. You may have some notification or approval requirements if there's going to be a change in team composition. Or you may have some requirements on the use of leverage, where you have the most junior but competent fee earner involved to keep costs down. Whatever your staffing requirements are, it's sensible to have them detailed from the outset. We typically include a paragraph in our engagement letters that reads, "We expect that lead counsel will supervise and personally participate in the primary matter activities. We also expect, however, that lead counsel will utilize other lawyers and paralegals as appropriate to effectively and cost-effectively manage our matters. Only approved attorneys and paralegals will be permitted to bill time on our matters. Before or as soon as reasonably possible after you are engaged to represent us in a matter, you should provide us with your plans to staff the matter, and we must be promptly notified of any staffing changes during the course of the matter." So that's one example of how we treat the issue of staffing in our engagement letters. We also find it's good practice in engagement retainer letters with local counsel that they specify that we specify that the prior written consent of us or the client is required for any subcontracting or any third party hiring or involvement before it can be undertaken by the local counsel. This is not only for cost control, but it really goes in a matter also of confidentiality and privilege. And we want to ensure that we have some measure of control over the parties that may have exposure to a client matter, first. And secondly, we want to have some quality control over the type of third parties that may be engaged in relation to a particular matter. So in addressing this issue, we typically include a paragraph in our engagement letters, which is quite short, but which reads, "The client's prior written consent is required for the retention of any counsel, experts, and consultants, such as expert witnesses, economists, etc. Selection of such third parties must be done in consultation with or at the direction of lead counsel or the client and prior agreed in writing before any engagement thereof." Now, to the extent possible, and I'll get to why it's not always possible, the engagement letter and retainer letter with local counsel should also endeavor to clarify who owns the ultimate work product being produced by that counsel, and ideally specifying who's the beneficiary and who privilege runs to. This is an issue that can be convoluted when multiple firms are involved or layers of firms exist between the client and the local law firm being engaged, and on the particular jurisdiction involved. Many foreign jurisdictions have very different rules when it comes to this. We try to address this issue in our engagement letters by stating, and we have this paragraph that we use, "All memoranda, reports, correspondence, and other attorney work product created in relation to whatever the matter is, or otherwise on behalf or for the benefit of the client, remains the property of the client to use as it deems appropriate, irrespective of whether such work product is delivered to us on behalf of the client, directly to the client, or otherwise." And on a related note, we have, as I mentioned earlier, the issue of privilege, which, depending on the nature of the matter, in particular for dealing with dispute resolution, litigation, or pre-litigation matters, is an issue that needs to be discussed and clarified in advance with local counsel. When you're dealing with a foreign jurisdiction, the rules governing privilege may, for example, preclude you as lead counsel from serving as a contractual counterparty to any engagement letter on behalf of a client with that co-counsel if you want the privilege to run to that ultimate client. And many times in jurisdictions, the local bars and the local authorities will want to see a direct engagement letter between the client and that local co-counsel to ensure that that's a privileged communication. And that's a contractual arrangement with the client, if proper retainers in place, so that all communications are going to remain privileged. So another consideration when you're deciding who's ultimately going to engage local counsel and be the contractual counterparty to an engagement letter is the issue of privilege. And then also, you on this point, you're going to want to ensure that your engagement letter specifies any local law requirements as to the labeling of advice or the labeling of email communications, stamping of certain communications that are necessary to protect the client's position in accordance with the rules on privileged communications in that jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions will have you require that you have to have privileged and confidential stamped on it from the outset if you want to retain that as it crosses borders. So different jurisdictions have different practices on what the labeling requirements are, and you'll want to deal with this upfront with your co-counsel and maybe even specified in your engagement terms just to make sure that all parties are adhering to that from the outset. Another consideration.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is FALL, F-A-L-L, FALL. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is FALL, F-A-L-L. Please take a moment and write this down.
That you'll want to deal with as part of your due diligence and in your engagement letter that we're increasingly finding to be good practice is to insert certain provisions in the engagement letter addressing the use of data. First, we strive to ensure that local counsel is using appropriate IT and data safeguards to maintain client-sensitive and confidential information at what we consider to be industry standard. But as we know, when you move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, what's considered industry standard can vary significantly. So you'll want to examine that your local counsel does have proper IT arrangements and data safeguards in place. Not only do that as part of our due diligence and vetting of local counsel from the outset, but then we also aim to address this specifically in our engagement letters. And in doing this, we'll often include a provision that would read something along the following. Your firm shall have in place and shall maintain at all times during the engagement appropriate industry standard physical, organizational, and technical processes and procedures to protect against any data security or data privacy breach related to information about or in relation to the project or the client or supplied by us as lead counsel on the project or the client and against any unlawful forms of processing, handling, or sharing of such data. In the event of an actual or reasonably suspected data security or data privacy breach related to such data, your firm shall notify us and the client not later than 48 hours after becoming aware of such data breach. Such notification must be provided at a minimum by email with a read receipt to, and you designate the person, and a copy to your firm's primary contact with us, and in facilitating the investigation or remediation of data breach, your firm shall fully cooperate with us or the client and shall not inform any third party of any data breach except as may be strictly required by applicable privacy laws. So as you can see, this is an area that's becoming increasingly important as we all are managing larger amounts of data and crossing borders with data. Additionally, on this subject, you're going to want to be mindful of the fact that there are certain types of data that cannot be legally transferred from one jurisdiction to the other jurisdiction these days. Many of you may have heard of the GDPR, the Global Data Protection Regulation, the EU has recently passed. And what we're finding is that there's certain types of data that maybe in the past could have been passed by local counsel to us in a due diligence report or in a summary of a data room that local counsel had gone into it based on our instructions. But we're increasingly finding that some of that data actually now legally cannot be transmitted to us. And in such instances, we then need to have local counsel perform the review of the data, instead of providing it to us for our review, we arrange for them to aggregate it, anonymize it, and transfer it to us in a way that's compliant with applicable legislation, but gets as much information to us that we can use for the benefit of the client. So these data privacy issues are a rapidly emerging area of law, and you'll want to ensure that you agree a modus operandi with your local counsel up front as to the collection and treatment of such data, and that any restrictions on the flow of information are included in your engagement letter and agreed and documented with your local counsel in advance. And then I think the last part, one of the final key matters that you're going to want to address in your engagement letter is liability and indemnification. And this is going to vary very much depending on the jurisdictions involved and the type of matter involved. And it's not always possible to find that a indemnification or disclaimer of liability provision will be enforceable. To the extent that you can talk about this up front with your co-counsel, see what is permissible and that you can address in an engagement letter, it's often advisable to do that so that everybody in advance knows ultimately what they're liable for in terms of co-counsel arrangements or joint advisory arrangements to a client. We, for example, often insert a disclaimer in our engagement letters, which reads, "Our firm is only advising on the laws of California, Illinois, or Delaware. If you require advice on the laws of other jurisdictions, we will, with your agreement, instruct lawyers licensed to practice in just such jurisdiction to give such advice. We will have no liability in respect of any advice rendered by such third parties or in respect to the laws of any such foreign jurisdiction. For the avoidance of doubt, we shall only be liable for any loss, damage, cost, or expense arising from any advice directly originating from our firm that is based on the laws of California, Illinois, or Delaware." We may also insist that an engagement letter with local counsel include an indemnity provision for us. Should we become embroiled in a dispute arising from their negligence? And this, of course, is controversial and something we're not always able to include in our engagement letters with local counsel, but we increasingly find it's good practice to try and include it when where we can and where it'll be enforceable. And then lastly, it's just good practice in your engagement letter with local counsel to specify under what circumstances and when you can terminate the representation. Co-counsel retainer agreements should explicitly memorialize the lead counsel and or the client's right to discharge the co-counsel at any time, and typically for any reason or no reason. That's what we usually include. And in such circumstances, we often like to have a provision where if the retainer agreement is terminated, such counsel will engage in a smooth transition of files as directed by us or the client as an obligation to wrapping up the engagement. And we do this because this is not necessarily an obligation that exists in all jurisdictions and can vary based on the bar rules of different countries. So we like to put that explicitly in the engagement letter. Okay, so you've now sourced, vetted, screened, diligenced potential co-counsel. You've obtained client consent in advance of the engagement with that counsel, and you've drafted a very detailed engagement letter. And we know, it's always exciting to sign up new clients, a new case, a new deal, and oftentimes we move very fast in doing it. But before you go on to actually executing the engagement letter, we find it's advisable to pause for a brief moment and give a long, hard thought as to liability in the context of your local counsel arrangements. And I touched upon this earlier, but the ability to split liability, disclaim liability, or manage liability in co-counsel arrangements varies greatly depending on the type of matter at issue and the jurisdictions that are involved. and it really is worth a proper review and consideration at the outset of your arrangements with another law firm, and doing your best to address these issues early on so everybody really has a very clear understanding of where they think their liability professionally lies within the mandate. And we, you know, courts are always going to be loath to limit the ability of a client to recover damages caused through the malpractice of a firm in a co-counsel arrangement. But, you know, there are still ways to limit or mitigate liability in co-counsel arrangements if you transparently discuss this with the client up front and between counsel up front, and you memorialize this in a fair and balanced manner. We've seen, you know, courts permitting co-counsel lawyers to successfully bring actions for contribution or indemnity when a lawyer is being sued for malpractice by a client and is able to offset his or her liability to the extent that the co-counsel for that client was the one responsible for the ultimate underlying act. So it's sensible to take some time to consider your particular matter at hand, understand any restrictions that may apply given the relevant jurisdictions involved, and take some steps in advance to clarify responsibility and liability as much as you can. So let's say you've now gone through the whole process. You've sourced, you've vetted diligence counsel, you've obtained your client's prior written consent to advance with the engagement of that counsel. You've drafted a very detailed engagement letter. You've assessed your liability issues, and you've now actually engaged local counsel and signed an executed retainer letter. One of the best measures we've found to keep our clients protected and to keep our relationships with co-counsel in good stead and to manage expectations of everyone concerned and to avoid things from falling through the cracks is to schedule and to implement what we call, you know, regular case monitoring roundups. However you label them, we would suggest it's best practice to schedule routine and frequent coordination conference calls with your co-counsel and your local counsel, just to review how things are going, what's coming up, whether there are any inter-firm administrative matters that would be worthwhile to deal with, such as holidays, billing arrangements, etc. This really immensely helps avoid missteps and concerns. And when you're dealing with foreign geographies, different languages, different cultures, different time zones, things can get lost in translation. And we have found that regularly scheduled conference calls to actively monitor a matter where you have co-counsel or local counsel, it builds camaraderie, it builds trust, it creates greater awareness. It just facilitates much better communication and project management, ultimately better protects the client. So to recap, many of us are increasingly finding our clients are crossing borders beyond our own jurisdictional licensures and are seeking very specialized advice, often beyond our own qualification and skills. And oftentimes these matters can be directly referred to competent counsel, or oftentimes, for a variety of reasons, the client wants us to retain control of the matter, to oversee and coordinate the matter. And in those cases, we're still ethically required to provide competent representation of the client, and the way of doing so is to associate with co-counsel or a lawyer that has the established licensure competency in that jurisdiction or that field in question. And as I mentioned earlier, in fact, failure to do so will result in an ethical violation because, you know, typically lawyers in virtually all jurisdictions in the U.S. are forbidden to handle a matter which they are not competent to handle. So the way around that is engaging competent counsel, co-counsel, with you on the matter. As I mentioned, there's no replacement for upfront solid due diligence. You'll want to scrutinize their bios, their credentials, their deal lists, size up their experience and expertise. You'll want to ensure that they're free of actual and foreseeable potential conflicts of interest. You'll want to assess their professional liability insurance to confirm that it's fitting and commensurate with the sort of liability that the underlying matter may trigger. and you'll want to confirm that they are at industry standards with respect to data protection. Once you've sourced and vetted counsel, it's best practice to organize an opportunity for a client to interview with that candidate co-counsel and obtain your client's prior written consent before engaging that counsel. As we touched upon, there's case law that suggests if you make that decision to engage counsel based on your own discretion, you materially increase your own liability for any malpractice on the part of that co-counsel. And then once you've diligenced and recommended a candidate to your client, you'll want to spend time crafting a very detailed engagement letter from the outset, specifying the scope of work and the division of responsibilities, responsibility for deadline tracking, details about agreed fee arrangements, staffing requirements, restrictions on third-party retention and subcontracting, who owns work product and who does the privilege belong to, and how will privilege be maintained, data security and data transfer requirements and restrictions, if you can, liability disclaimers and indemnification terms, and then lastly, rights of termination in the process for file transition. And then once, as I said earlier, once the matter is underway, take the time to proactively monitor your project with co-counsel with frequent and routine monitoring calls. Do this in a proactive way to mitigate the risk of anything important falling through the cracks during your representation. So that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope this past hour or so was helpful in providing some useful, practical, and ethical considerations when engaging local counsel, co-counsel. As I noted earlier, my name is Ted Caminos. I'm a corporate partner in the Chicago office of Fagerty Baker Daniels. If you have any questions or comments about this, you should feel free to call me. My number is 312-356-5058. My email is ted.caminos@fagerybd.com. Thank you very much for attending, and good luck in your future co-counsel, local counsel engagements. Thank you.